Ja, hallo, hier ist Felicia Herrschaft, heute mit einer Sendung, und zwar spiele ich ein Gespräch, das Nancy Fraser in Prag geführt hat, und zwar zu dem Thema Abnormal Justice. Und Nancy Fraser ist gerade Professorin für politische und soziale Wissenschaften, Social Science, an der New School in New York. Und sie ist sozusagen konzentriert auf Social and Political Theory, Feminist Theory, Contemporary and French and some sort. Und dieser Vortrag, da steigen wir direkt ein, ist auch Richard Rorty gewidmet. Und sie diskutiert eben verschiedene Bezüge, wie man jetzt die Diskussion über Theorien der Gerechtigkeit neu definieren kann. Und hier im Hintergrund ist ein Auszug, und zwar geht es hier darum, hören wir hier eine Aufnahme aus einem Club in Prag, in dem so Kids so ihre neuen Mixe vorgestellt haben.
Claim looks like. So they share, for example, assumptions about the kinds of actors who are entitled to make such claims, often individuals, about the kind of agency from which one should seek redress, often a territorial state, about the circle of interlocutors to whom claims for justice should be addressed, often one's fellow citizens, about the universe of those whose interests or concerns deserve consideration, also often one's fellow citizens, about the space, the conceptual space in which questions of justice can intelligibly arise, for example, the space of economic distribution, and so on. In such contexts, where those who argue about justice share a set of underlying assumptions, their contests assume a relatively regular and recognizable shape, constituted through a set of organizing principles, manifesting a discernible grammar. Such conflicts take the form of what I'm calling normal justice. Now, let me qualify immediately that it is doubtful that justice discourse is ever fully normal in the sense I've just described. There may well be no real-world context in which public debates about justice remain wholly within the bounds set by a given set of constitutive assumptions. Never a case in which every participant shares every assumption. And of course, whenever a situation approaching normality does appear, we might well suspect that it rests on the suppression or marginalization of those who dissent from the reigning consensus. Still, I want to insist that we may speak of normal justice in a meaningful sense. By analogy with Thomas Kuhn's understanding of normal science, justice discourse is normal just so long as public dissent from and disobedience to its constitutive assumptions remains contained. So long as deviations remain private or appear as anomalies, so long as they do not accumulate and destructure the discourse, then the field of public sphere argument over justice retains this recognizable and normal shape. Okay, by this standard, I want to suggest the present context is one of abnormal justice. Even as public debates about justice proliferate, they increasingly lack the structured character of normal discourse. Today's disputants often lack any shared understanding of what the authors of justice claims should look like, as some countenance groups or communities as subjects of claims, while others would admit only individuals. Likewise, those who argue about justice today often share no view of the agency of redress, as some envision new transnational or cosmopolitan institutions, while others restrict appeals to territorial states. Then, two, the disputants often hold divergent views of the proper circle of interlocutors and of those whose interests count and deserve consideration, as some address their claims to international public opinion and think accord standing to global humanity, while others would confine discussion within bounded polities and restrict standing to their fellow citizens. And of course, those who argue about justice today often disagree about this question of conceptual space. Some admit only economic claims for redistribution, others also claims for recognition or political representation. The result is that current debates about justice have a freewheeling character. Absent the ordering force of shared presuppositions, they lack the structured shape of normal discourse. Now, I think this is patently true for informal contests over justice in civil society, where, of course, it's always been possible in principle to problematize doxa. We might cite the example of the affair of the Danish cartoons, which I would submit is better grasped as a species of abnormal discourse about justice than as a clash of civilizations. But abnormality also swirls around institutionalized arenas of argument, such as courts and arbitration bodies, whose principal raison d'etre is precisely to normalize justice. Here I'm thinking of a U.S. example, the dispute among the justices of our Supreme Court in a recent death penalty case over whether or not it is proper to cite opinions from foreign courts. Right? They tried to cite an opinion from the European Court of Justice, and the conservative justice says, but that's, you can't do that. We are, you know, not bound by such opinions. Well, these are cases in which not only first-order questions of justice, but the very grammar of justice itself is up for grabs. Now, I want to qualify this by noting right away that this situation is by no means unprecedented. There are, I'm sure, many prior eras of this kind of abnormal justice. For example, the period in Europe leading up to the Treaty of Westphalia, the treaty following World War One. The period following World War One, and I would even venture to guess that normal justice is historically abnormal, and abnormal justice represents the historical norm. Nevertheless, I want to insist that today's abnormalities are historically specific, that they reflect recent developments, including the breakup of the Cold War, order, contested U.S. hegemony, the rise of neoliberalism, and, of course, the new salience of globalization, among many other things. Under these conditions, claims for justice easily become unmoored from any pre-existing islands of normalcy. In the wake of transnationalized production and globalized finance, claims for redistribution increasingly trespass the bounds of state-centered grammars and arenas of argument. Given transnational migration and global media flows, the claims for recognition of once distant others acquire a new proximity, destabilizing taken-for-granted horizons of cultural value. And of course, in an era of contested superpower hegemony, global governance, and transnational politics, claims for political representation increasingly break the previous frame of the territorial state. So this is a context, I'm arguing, of denormalization, in which justice claims immediately run up against counterclaims whose underlying assumptions they don't always share. Now, let me suggest that in this situation, our familiar theories of justice offer little guidance. Formulated for contexts of normal justice, they focus largely on first-order questions. What constitutes a just distribution of resources or wealth? What counts as reciprocal recognition or equal respect? What constitutes fair terms of political representation and equal voice? Premised on a shared grammar, these theories do not tell us how to proceed when we encounter conflicting assumptions about the basic parameters of justice, and so they fail to provide the conceptual resources we need to deal with problems of abnormal justice, which are so characteristic of the present era. My question here is, what sort of theorizing about justice could provide guidance in this situation? And in the lecture here, I want to suggest a way of approaching questions of injustice in abnormal times. First, I'm going to try to identify three nodes of abnormality in contemporary disputes about justice. And then I'm not going to have time to discuss all of them, but I'm going to formulate a corresponding conceptual strategy for dealing at least with one of these three nodes. In the longer paper, I try to deal with all of them. All right, but I want to begin by sketching a recent dispute over social justice just to make this whole problem a little more concrete. Claiming to promote justice for workers at home and abroad, labor unions in developed countries seek to block imports whose production conditions do not meet domestic environmental health and safety standards. Organizations representing workers in the developing world object that in imposing standards they cannot possibly meet at the present time, this seemingly progressive approach is actually a species of unjust protectionism. Debated in both domestic and transnational public spheres, the first position finds support among those who advocate the pursuit of justice through democratic politics at the level of the territorial state, while the second is championed both by proponents of global justice and by free marketeers. Meanwhile, corporations and states dispute related issues in international legal arenas. For example, a NAFTA, North American Free Trade Association, arbitration panel hears arguments from a U.S.-based multinational which contends that Canada's relatively stringent environmental and labor laws constitute an illegal restraint on trade. The U.S. representative on the three-judge panel finds for the corporation on free trade grounds. The Canadian representative finds against, invoking the self-government rights of the Canadian citizenry. The Mexican representative cast the deciding vote. Finding for the corporation and thus siding with the United States, he invokes poor nations' right to development. At the same time, however, the legitimacy of these proceedings is disputed. In transnational civil society, demonstrators protest against NAFTA, as against the WTO and other governance structures of the global economy. Pronouncing these structures undemocratic and unjust, activists meeting at the World Social Forum debate the contours of an alternative globalization from below. Okay, this is an example of what I mean by abnormal justice. Traversing multiple discursive arenas, the locus of argument is itself an object of dispute. Offshore contestants strive to pierce the bounds of domestic debates, while nationalists and country-level Democrats seek to territorialize them. Meanwhile, states and corporations work to contain disputes within regional juridical institutions, whereas transnational social movements strive to widen them. So the very shape of the controversy, something which you would expect would be uncontested in normal discourse, is here a focus of explicit struggle. Even as they dispute substantive issues then, the contestants also rehearse deep disagreements about who is entitled to address claims to whom concerning what, about where and how such claims should be vetted, and about who is obliged to redress them if and when they are vindicated. The abnormalities are not wholly random, however. I think they constellate around three principal nodes. The first node reflects the absence of a shared view of the what of justice, At issue here, then, is the matter or substance of justice, the substance with which it's concerned. Now, such matters would go without saying in normal justice, as, for example, when all parties conceive justice in distributive terms, as concerned with the allocation of divisible goods, typically economic in nature. But in the conflict I just stressed, by contrast, the what of justice is in dispute. Here, offshore workers' economic claims aimed at combating distributive injustice collide with a territorial citizenry's political claims, which are aimed at defending the democratic sovereignty of a bounded polity. So the result is a lack of consensus as to how to understand the injustice, assuming there is one, let alone how to redress it. The very what of justice is in dispute. A A second node of abnormality reflects the lack of a shared understanding of what I want to call the who of justice. At issue here is the question of scope, the frame within which justice applies. Who counts in a given matter? Whose interests and concerns deserve consideration? Again, such matters would go without saying in normal justice, as, for example, when all parties frame their disputes as matters internal to territorial states, thereby equating the who of justice with the citizenry of a bounded polity. But in the argument I just sketched, in contrast, the who is precisely up for grabs. Here, some of the disputants evaluate Canadian labor regulations in terms of their domestic effects, while others consider the effects on the larger North American region, and still others look further afield to the interests of workers in the developing world or even to those of global humanity. So there's a lack of consensus about who counts, not just the what, but also the who of justice is in dispute. The third node of abnormality reflects the lack of a shared understanding of what I want to call the how of justice. And here, of course, the issue is procedural. How, in a given case, should one resolve these disputes about the what and the who? Now, in normal justice, such questions would not arise by definition, as the what and the who are not in dispute. But in the argument I just sketched, we encounter conflicting scenarios for resolving disputes. Whereas states and corporations look to NAFTA for resolution, anti-neoliberalism activists look instead to international public opinion. So here, not just the what and the who, but also the how of justice is up for grabs. Together, these three nodes of abnormality reflect the destabilization of a previously hegemonic grammar. Today's uncertainty about the what reflects the decentering of that grammar's understanding of the matter or substance of justice. What has been problematized here is the view that identifies justice exclusively with fair economic distribution. That understanding, I want to suggest, organized the lion's share of argument in the decades following World War II, subtending First World social democracy, Second World communism, and even Third World developmentalism. The distributive interpretation of the what cast maldistribution or economic inequality, class inequality, as the quintessential injustice, while, of course, marginalizing non-economic harms that could not be understood in those terms. Analogously, today's uncertainty about the who reflects the destabilization of a previous grammar's frame. In this case, what has been problematized is the Westphalian view that the modern territorial state is the sole unit within which justice applies. Now, that view framed most justice discourse in the post-World War II era. In conjunction with the distributive conception, it organized otherwise disparate political cultures throughout the world, despite lip service to human rights, proletarian internationalism, and third world solidarity. I think in the end, everyone was really a nationalist when it came to these questions of distribution, almost everyone. Effectively territorializing justice, then, the Westphalian frame equated the scope of concern with the citizenry of a bounded political community and thereby marginalized the whole problem of trans-border injustices. Today's understanding concerning the how reflects the new salience of a previously unspoken feature of the post-war grammar. What has become visible and therefore contestable is a hidden hegemonic assumption. So long as the lion's share of justice discourse was governed by Westphalian and distributivist assumptions, there was little overtly perceived need for institutions and procedures for resolving disputes about the what and the who. On those occasions when such a need was perceived, it was assumed that powerful states and private elites would resolve those disputes in intergovernmental organizations or perhaps more likely in smoke-filled back rooms. So the effect was to discourage open democratic contestation about the what and the who. Today, however, I'm suggesting that none of these three normalizing assumptions goes without saying. The hegemony of the distributive what has been challenged from at least two sides. First, by diverse practitioners of the politics of recognition, ranging from multiculturalists who seek to accommodate differences to ethno-nationalists who seek to eliminate them. And second, by diverse practitioners of the politics of representation, ranging from feminists campaigning for gender quotas on electoral lists to national minorities demanding power-sharing arrangements. So I'm suggesting that there are now in play at least three rival conceptions of the what of justice, possibly more, but at least these three: redistribution, recognition, representation. Meanwhile, the hegemony of the Westphalian who has been challenged from at least three directions. First, by localists and communalists who seek to locate the scope of concern in subnational units. Second, by regionalists and transnationalists who propose to identify the who of justice with larger, though not yet fully universal, units, such as Europe or Islam. And third, by globalists and cosmopolitans who propose to accord equal consideration to all human beings. So there are now in play at least four rival views of the who of justice, namely Westphalian, local communalist, transnational, regional, and global cosmopolitan. Finally, the silent sway of the hegemonic how has been challenged by a general rise in democratic expectations as mobilized movements of all of these kinds demand a say about the what and the who. Contesting hegemonic institutions and frames, such movements have effectively challenged the prerogative of states and elites to determine the grammar of justice. Inciting broad debates about the what and the who, they have put in play, alongside the hegemonic presumption, populist and democratic views of the how of justice. Well, the appearance of these rival views concerning the what, the who, and the how poses a major problem for anyone who cares about injustice today. Somehow, we must work through these meta-disputes without losing sight of pressing first-order problems of injustice. But with all three parameters in play simultaneously, we have no firm ground on which to stand. Abnormality confronts us at every turn. So my question is, what sort of justice theorizing could provide guidance in this situation? And the general key to the approach that I'm trying to develop in this paper involves appreciating both the positive and the negative sides of abnormal justice. The positive side is an expansion of the field of contestation, which means the chance to challenge harms that the previous grammar covered over, such as the harms of misrecognition and misrepresentation and trans-border injustices. So that's the positive side. But the negative side is that under these conditions, we have reduced means for actually overcoming injustice, given the absence of any relatively stable framework in which claims can be equitably vetted, and the absence of adequate institutionalized agencies who can effect redress. So I want to suggest that anyone who wants to try to theorize justice in abnormal times needs to keep both sides of that equation in view, and to ask what sort of theorizing could simultaneously valorize expanded contestation and cope with this question of diminished capacities of adjudication and redress. Now, without it pretending in any way to present a full answer to that question, my strategy would be to hunt for clues by re-examining the three nodes of abnormality that I described. My hunch is that when we would go back and consider each of them in turn, each could tell us something important about how to think about justice in abnormal times. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to leave out any discussion of the what and the how. I'm going to go directly to the who, which for me, in a way, is the one that's quite pressing. So here the question is how to accommodate both, right, the positive and the negative sides of abnormal justice. And here I would ask then, what sort of theorizing can valorize contestation of the Westphalian frame while also clarifying disputes that encompass conflicting views about who counts, and in a way that holds out some hope, right, for really imagining discourses that could resolve such disputes. And the very short answer that I want to propose here is that for this purpose, we need theorizing that is simultaneously reflexive and substantive. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. In order to valorize expanded contestation, reflection on abnormal justice must be open to claims that first-order questions of justice have been wrongly framed. To ensure that such claims receive a fair hearing, one should assume at the outset that injustices of misframing, as I want to call it, can exist in principle. That is, that you can create an injustice by using the wrong frame for thinking about questions of justice. For example, if you wrongly exclude consideration of some who deserve inclusion, or vice versa, if you wrongly include some who shouldn't be there. So what that means is that abnormal justice theorizing must be reflexive, able to jump to the next level, to problematize the justice of the prevailing frame. Only by becoming reflexive in this way can one grasp the question of the who precisely as a question of justice. So how can one generate the reflexivity needed here to think about abnormal justice? The strategy I propose, which actually I've presented here in a previous year, it draws on a distinctive conception of the political dimension of justice, which, although I haven't spoken about it here, is one of three dimensions of justice that I argue in a previous section should be used for thinking about this question, the what. Now, the normal way is to consider the political dimension of justice as in terms of questions that arise within a political community whose boundaries and membership are already assumed to be settled. And so you would ask about whether the polity's decision rules are fair, whether all who are counted as members have the chance to participate equally and fully as peers. And of course, those questions are very important, but they represent, I think, only half the story when we think about the political dimension of justice. Equally important are what I want to call metapolitical injustices, which arise not within a bounded community, but rather as a result of the division of political space into bounded political communities. Such injustices occur when a polity's boundaries are drawn in such a way as to wrongly deny some people the chance to participate at all in its authorized contests over justice. In such cases, those who are constituted as non-members are wrongly excluded from the universe of those entitled to consideration within the polity in matters of distribution, recognition, and, let us say, ordinary political representation. And I want to insist that this sort of injustice, I'm giving you the general concept of it, remains even when those who are excluded from one polity are included as subjects of justice in another, so long as the effect of the political division, the division of political space, is such as to put some relevant aspects of justice beyond their reach, as when the international system of supposedly but not really equal sovereign states gerrymanders political space at the expense of the global poor, leaving them no way to actually make claims on the actual agencies of their dispossession. And that's what I mean by the idea of misframing. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Now, so here's a way of thinking this notion of misframing that allows us to think reflexively, right, about whether first-order framings of justice might themselves be unjust. And so this is the kind of notion that gives us the reflexivity, I'm arguing, that we need to parse disputes about the who in abnormal justice. However, reflexivity itself is not a solution. As soon as we accept that injustices of misframing can exist in principle, we require some means of deciding when and where they exist in reality. So a theory of justice for abnormal times requires not only this kind of reflexivity, but in addition, a substantive normative principle for evaluating frames. Absent such a substantive principle, we would have no way to assess the alternatives, hence no way to clarify disputes that encompass conflicting understandings of the who of justice. So what might a substantive principle for evaluating frames look like? I want to suggest that there are currently three major candidates for such a principle on offer. The first is what I'll call the membership principle. Proponents of this principle propose to resolve disputes concerning the who by appealing to criteria of political belonging. So for them, what turns a collection of individuals into fellow subjects of justice is shared citizenship or shared nationality. And this would encompass everyone from David Miller on the nationality principle to Thomas Nagel, who understands it in terms of citizenship. Rawls lies somewhere in between with the notion of people. I don't know if that's a nation or a citizenship idea, but in any case, it's a membership principle. And I think Shayla Ben-Habib even has a version of this membership principle. So it's a widely held view. And of course, it has a tremendous advantage. Namely, it is grounded in existing institutional reality and or in widely held collective identifications. But of course, that advantage is also a great weakness, because in practice, the membership principle serves all too easily to ratify the exclusionary nationalisms of the privileged and the powerful, hence to shield established frames from critical scrutiny. So let's consider a second principle, which I will call the humanist principle. Proponents of this approach propose to resolve disputes concerning the who by appealing to criteria of personhood. For them, what turns a collection of individuals into fellow subjects of justice is common possession of distinguishing features of humanity, whether it's autonomy, rationality, language capacity, etc., etc. Probably the most prominent proponent of this approach is Martha Nussbaum, but there are others. Now, because this approach appeals to this criteria of personhood to delimit frames, it actually provides a critical check on exclusionary nationalism, which is a good thing. However, its lofty abstraction is also a weakness. Cavalierly oblivious to actual or historical social relations, it accords standing indiscriminately to everyone in respect of everything. And thus, it forecloses the possibility that different issues and different questions require different frames or scales of justice. So let's look for a third possibility that might introduce the ability to make such distinctions. Here we have lots of people who defend, and I myself in the past have defended, although I'm not going to do it here, the so-called all-affected principle. Aiming to conceptualize transnational justice, proponents of this approach propose to resolve disputes about the who by appealing to social relations of interdependence. So for them, what makes a group of people fellow subjects of justice is their objective co-imbrication in a web of causal relationships. This is a view you can find in Peter Singer, in Thomas Paga, and if I remember correctly, Iris Young defended this conception in this very room last year. Now, this approach certainly has the merit of providing a critical check on self-serving notions of membership while also taking cognizance of actual social relations. So those are its advantages. Yet I want to suggest that it can fall prey to the reductio ad absurdum of the so-called butterfly effect, which holds that everyone is affected by everything. In other words, it remains incomplete insofar as it fails to identify which are the morally relevant kinds of social interconnections and causal vulnerability. And unless it can do that, it's going to collapse into the very one-size-fits-all globalism that it was designed originally to avoid. Okay, so given the problems that each of these three approaches has, I want to propose an alternative principle. Actually, it's one that David Owen already proposed here in the previous session, which I am going to call the all-subjected principle. principle. According to this principle, all those who are subject to a given governance structure have moral standing as subjects of justice in relation to it. On this view, what turns a collection of people into fellow subjects of justice is neither shared citizenship nor shared nationality nor common possession of abstract personhood, nor the sheer fact of causal interdependence, but rather their joint subjection to a structure of governance which sets the ground rules that govern some aspect of their interaction. For any such governance structure, the all-subjected principle would match the scope of moral concern to that of subjection. Now, of course, everything depends here on how we interpret this phrase, subjection to a structure of governance. I understand this expression quite broadly as encompassing relations to powers of various types, not restricted to states, although including states. Governance structures also comprise non-state agencies that generate enforceable rules that structure important swaths of social interaction. Obvious examples are the agencies that set the ground rules of the global economy, such as the World Trade Organization, the IMF, and so on and so forth. Many, many other examples of such transnational structures could be cited. Insofar as they regulate the interaction of large transnational populations, they count as governance structures even though the rulemakers are not accountable presently to those whom they govern. On my understanding, then, the expression subjection to a governance structure is not restricted to formal citizenship or even to the broader condition of falling within the jurisdiction of a state when you're a non-citizen. Rather, it also encompasses the further condition of being subject to the coercive power of non-state and trans-state forms of governmentality. Okay, I want to suggest that, understood in this way, the all-subjected principle affords a critical standard for assessing alternative ways of framing questions of justice. An issue is justly framed if and only if everyone subjected to the governance structures that regulate the relevant swaths of social interaction is accorded equal consideration. To deserve such consideration, moreover, one need not already be an officially accredited member of the structure in question. In other words, one need only be subjected to it. So, for example, sub-Saharan Africans who have been involuntarily disconnected from the global economy as a result of the rules imposed by its governance structures count as subjects of justice in relation to it, even if they are not counted officially as participating in the International Division of Labor. Okay, I'm running out of time. I think I hope I don't need to sort of enumerate the ways in which this principle, I think, overcomes each of the defects I recorded of the previous principle. I think that may be clear enough already. So I want to just say that this kind of approach, which combines the reflexive questioning of justice frames with a substantive evaluative principle, is intended, and I hope succeeds, in accommodating both the positive and negative sides of abnormal justice. Thanks to its reflexivity, this concept of misframing that I have proposed validates contestation of the Westphalian frame. At the same time, thanks to its substantive character, this all-subjected principle offers a way of assessing the justice of various frames. And so I hope that it helps us to clarify disputes about the who in abnormal times. All right, I'm going to give you a conclusion that summarizes more than I actually argued, just so you can see what I left out, okay? I have tried to argue that a theory of justice suited to conditions of abnormal discourse should combine three features. First, it should encompass an account of the what of justice, I didn't present it here, that combines a multidimensional social ontology with a normative monism. I think some of you who know my recent work will, this will sound familiar to you. For example, an account that submits claims for justice in three dimensions, redistribution, recognition, and ordinary political representation to the principle of participatory parity, multidimensional social ontology, normative monism. Second, I really did argue here that a theory should encompass a view of the who that is simultaneously reflexive and substantive. For example, one that submits claims against injustices of misframing to the all-subjective principle. Finally, I argue, although not here, that a theory of justice for abnormal times should encompass a view of the how of justice that is simultaneously dialogical and institutional. For example, a view that envisions new global representative institutions where metapolitical claims can be submitted to deliberative democratic procedures. Didn't argue that. In any case, more important than these specifics, which could turn out maybe to be wrong or less illuminating than I now believe they are, more important than that is the general problem I've tried to outline here. Under conditions of abnormal justice, previously taken for granted assumptions about the what, the who, and the how no longer go without saying. And so these assumptions must themselves be subject to critical discussion and reevaluation. In such discussions, the trick is to avoid two things, I think. On the one hand, one should try to resist the reactionary and ultimately futile temptation to cling to assumptions that are no longer appropriate to our current world, such as reductive distributivism and passé Westphalianism. On the other hand, one should avoid celebrating abnormality for its own sake, as if contestation were itself liberation. Here, I've tried to model an alternative stance which acknowledges abnormal justice as the horizon within which all struggles against injustice must currently proceed. Only by appreciating both the perils and the prospects of this condition can we hope to even begin to envision a way of reducing the vast injustices that now pervade our world. Thank you.
Jetzt gibt es noch Nachfragen zu dem Vortrag von Nancy Fraser.
Okay, all of you, okay. So we will continue in this line.
And three or four at once.
Okay, okay. So just please. Okay, and you too.
Bill.
Yes, Bill. Yes. Okay, we will start here. Okay, yes. Please go ahead. Continue.
I'm not sure in your structure where a number of questions about the who of justice fall. Animals, future generations, trees, children, fetuses, which I suspect. Yes, I didn't know where in her structure a number of questions about the who of justice fell, such as animals, future generations, children, fetuses, trees, fell, though, you know, they're much disputed. And so I just wanted you to clarify that. I don't want you to solve those problems, but I don't think the principle you gave you want to apply to all of those circumstances.
Should I answer this? Or
no, no, no. Okay. The mic stands here. Definitely not.
Just along the same lines, just given your very brief comments, I'm not sure that I would see how the all-subjective principle improves on the all-effective principle for the following reason. The determination of the scope of the all-effective principle, namely the problem of the butterfly effect, that's not something that's determined as an objective fact. It's something that's determined in discursive practices, which means that there's always a second-order inclusionary discourse about whether or not one's claims that one's affected are, in fact, justifiable. And that's why groups that petitioned for inclusion in a particular kind of, let's say, national debate are going to have to, A, have some sort of mechanism for, at least to have their reasons justified. I guess that's just A. But that means that things like all of those affected will have to introduce justificatory accounts of, I'm significantly affected, my basic interests are affected. They're affected in ways that a matter of strict justice. So if that's true, then there's always going to be a second-order inclusion debate where the very possibility of inclusion is also a matter of discourse, and that seems to me to be to withdraw the difference between a subjection and an inclusion, effectiveness.
Hartmut?
Yeah, Nancy, I very much like what you're doing, and I think it's very useful to conceptualize the current situation or the situation concerning justice through the rorty, or in fact, as you said, it's the Kuhnian idea, right, of normal and abnormal justice. And I think there are two important consequences coming from Kuhn, which you don't seem to buy, right?
Yeah.
Because the opposite of normal justice in Kuhnian language is revolutionary justice, right? And it's only a short period for which there can be an absence of a paradigm. And then there needs to be a new paradigm, so that there can be a very long situation of abnormal justice. There must be a new paradigm, and if it's not coming forward, I think the consequence is that then justice is no longer the issue, right? Then the problem, the world solves its problems not through justice, but through power, for example, and I think isn't that much the more likely a consequence. And the other problem with Kuhn, of course, is there is no meta-principle to distinguish between different paradigms, right? So you seem to suggest, well, we need reflexivity and contestation to decide which is the right new paradigm, but for Kuhn, it's conversion. So what you need is political conversion for a new paradigm of justice.
Okay, so please explain your new paradigm.
Okay. These are all really good and I think very difficult questions. In the case of Steve, I just have to kind of bite the bullet and say that I am assuming that candidates for possible components of a who are persons. And so from your list, I would include children, but not fetuses. I recognize that that's contestable, and we could, you know, people might argue about that. I'm not including trees. But I am including future generations, because I think that although these, we often tend to use a kind of spatial imaginary to thinking about these issues of unjust inclusion and exclusion in a frame, there is also a temporal problematic. So I do think that the exclusion of concern for future generations is a form of misframing. Yeah. Max, you anticipate exactly where I'm going with this third node about the how. I do envision exactly what you call the second-order inclusion debate. I don't imagine there are technocratic justice experts who would apply the all-affected principle or the all-subjected principle or whatever, although I do believe, and we've argued this here before, that social science knowledge is directly relevant to those questions, but it enters into a democratic debate rather than being sort of handed down from on high. So I definitely do see, if I had a chance to do the third part, I would have tried to talk about this question of how to envision the how. And in a sense, you could say that my proposal for an all-subjected principle is a proposal for sort of what the appropriate idiom of public reason should be within that how, what we should be arguing about. And I grant you that there are people, and until recently I was one of them, who thought you could do fine with this all-affected principle, and simply specify, like, for example, Carol Gould does, I'm affected if my fundamental human rights are in danger, then that's the cutoff line, or Held has a division into sort of 3 degrees of affectedness. I mean, there are people definitely working to try to make this operationalizable. But I have to say that I've been very influenced by an exchange of papers of the last year or so in Philosophy and Public Affairs between Thomas Nagel and Joshua Cohen and Charles Sable. And they convinced me that this notion that justice is fundamentally a political notion, and that what we need is some way to talk about people who stand in a political relation to one another. And that debate in Philosophy and Public Affairs was over what counts as a political relation, with Nagel defending the most traditional view that it means you're all, you know, citizens of one state. And Cohen and Sable insisting that for our world today, we stand in political relations by being subjected to all other kinds of powers. And this notion of all subjected is intended, in a way, to take on board and to acknowledge that people who have tried to defend the membership principle do have an insight that justice is fundamentally a political relation. And I want to take that on board, but expand it or develop it in a way that makes sense for our... where there are questions of power, there are questions of justice. That's sort of, in a sense, the idea. And then finally, Hartmut, you're definitely right. I think it's... I hope it would be obvious why I preferred the notion to use the phrase abnormal justice to revolutionary justice. That was a deliberate decision on my part. And I think you're probably right about Kuhn, that in the history of modern physical sciences, what at least from his point of view, what it looks like are sort of extended periods of normal science where a paradigm is developed, punctuated by briefer moments of abnormality. And I suspect that is not the case, that here the this issue of justice discourse, as I said, I think that normal justice is quite aberrant, historically, right, unusual. And I think that the pathos of our situation today is that we are kind of at the sort of breakdown in the throes of the crumbling of one of those few periods of relative normality with respect to justice. And that has pathos because from the First World perspective, you could call this social democratic paradigm, but I think it has analogs in the Second and Third World. A paradigm that actually allowed us to do things.
Yes.
Although we now see all of its exclusionary dimensions, both internal and external. And so that's why there's a loss and a gain here when we move beyond that. You're quite right that for Kuhn there is no meta principle that could adjudicate competing paradigms. And I am breaking with him in that sense. But I have to say that I might soften the contrast between kind of rational adjudication with a meta principle and quote unquote conversion. I mean, it's one thing, you know, what we philosophers sort of do in our cogitating, you know, exercises. But if you actually think of the real processes by which something like a new justice paradigm could crystallize, then I think we are really talking about the medium of social struggle and so on, where maybe it's a political. Anyway, it's maybe neither exactly rational meta principle. But one last point about that. One thing I see myself doing is trying to create some language and some arguments that those forces in the world that I think are sort of on the side of the good could use. So these are.
So I'm on the right. Virginia?
Yes, perhaps I go to misunderstand you. But I found your suggestion to take the principle of subjective to an institution. In this sense, I find it interesting, this sense, because then the question about justice became of terms to be at the same time, it involves a question of efficiency, in my opinion. Because you have to solve the problem of justice in the sense to create at the same time the resources in order to maintain or to have the institution that enforces and improves the decision. And I think that's very interesting. That's the problem of law, of right. You have to decide something in a just way, but at the same time, the decision must be so that you have the resources in order to enforce the decision with the right or law administration. And then this union, this unification between practical and theoretical reason is very important, in my opinion, and not to see the problem of justice only as a problem of practical. That's my perhaps a misunderstanding.
Okay, another one.
Ja, das war eine Sendung mit einem Vortrag von Nancy Fraser, der Anfang Mai in Prag stattgefunden hat. Der Titel war Abnormal Justice. Und wer weitere Informationen oder zu diesem Vortrag haben möchte, kann das auch unter www.fehe.org dann sich anschauen. Okay, bis dann. Am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia Herrschaft.